We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Welcome to Sidetrack, AM580's monthly features magazine. I'm your host, Jason Croft. This month, we talked to an Illinois teacher who has made it her mission this year to eat the same school lunches her students eat and to blog about it. We hear about how butchery classes are becoming popular. We chat with the widow of Western writer Louis L'Amour. And we learn about two men who build musical instruments that run on solar power. We'll have those stories and more this time on Sidetrack. When you hear stories about solar power, it's usually within the larger discussion of renewable energies and going green. But in New York City, two students have been devising ways to use sunlight to make some music. More from independent producer Emma Jacobs.
Let's see, if I start this guy up,
you'll notice.
Kind of turns on with a pulse, turns off, and that's it storing the energy, releasing it, storing it, releasing it. And as I move the light closer, you'll hear that the interval becomes much, much faster.
Chris Cerrito has always liked building gadgets, especially ones that could move. On the first day of one of his graduate classes in NYU's Interactive Technology program, he found himself with an assignment: to create a musical instrument. Mike Rosenthal was also in the room that day. He'd been in high school when he'd first been given an old 8-track reel-to-reel. His first reaction had been to try to make music with it.
I was living in the garage of my parents' house, and I just got excited. I was taking all the weird things that were around and just throwing them all together. This idea that you could just take things from the natural world and create rhythm and looping things and sort of piecing things together, it was, for me, really new and pretty exciting.
Pretty soon, these two decided to team up.
As we sort of got talking, we realized we had similar interest in finding a way to make things that were sort of self-sustainable. And we're just, yeah, like these little self-contained guys that would just sort of run around and do their own thing.
I had recently been playing with little machines and kind of had started to realize that you can create these really complex things out of these tiny little simple things interacting and layering these sounds together.
A tiny box on legs rattles across the table as Rosenthal holds up a bright lamp. Together, the two created a small army of musical instruments that all run on solar power. There's the thrumbot, which sounds a little like a movie sound effect of a thunderstorm, and the xylobot, made out of old children's xylophone parts. Cerrito explains that most of their creations are built roughly along the same lines.
There's the panel on top, and this is what collects the energy, and then underneath we have this little circuit board, and this is the actual solar engine. And what's going on here is the energy from the panel is stored in this capacitor. Kind of think of a capacitor as sort of like a battery until it hits a certain voltage. And then that energy is then released. And that causes this little guy to scooch around and make some weird noises.
They've made all these machines out of surprisingly simple technology.
These panels we bought off eBay, and they cost roughly, I think, $1 a piece, maybe $1.25. These are little pager motors, the same kind of motor that's in your cell phone that would make it vibrate.
All the same, Cerrito says he still really likes working with these components.
There's something kind of crazy magical, it still feels like, to watch these little objects pop into action.
Both admit solar is definitely a buzzword. They don't expect to be solving major energy problems anytime soon with their work.
But on the other hand, I think it's awesome.
Mike Rosenthal.
This was this mysterious black box. It's solar. It's like, how can you know how to do anything with solar? And now it's like, oh, because it's not very hard. Because, you know, it's, you get a little bit of information, a little bit of knowledge, and suddenly you're empowered to make all sorts of stuff. When you drive past hundreds or thousands of solar panels, it's like, I bet those are doing great things for that city. Like, I don't really have a way of physically holding or gauging or understanding that. But when you can hold a little musical instrument and, like, feel it vibrating from nothing but the sun, it's like, okay, I get that. I'm going to hold it up to the sun and it's going to go forever. I'm going to leave it in the desert and it's going to run until it rusts.
That feature from independent producer Emma Jacobs. This is Sidetrack. For those who attended public school growing up, you probably have vivid memories of the lunches the school served to you. For most, these would not be fond memories. Vivid, yes. Fond, no. School lunches seem to be something students tolerate rather than enjoy. There is one Illinois school teacher who is trying to bring attention to what she feels is lacking in school lunches. Her goal this year is to eat the same lunches offered to students every day and then blog about it at her site, fedupwithschoollunch.blogspot.com. Her blog, which has only been around for a short time, has gathered a bit of a following. Now, doing this project is not without risks. Our blogging teacher goes only by the name of Mrs. Q for fear that she could lose her job if her identity was known. I talked with Mrs. Q recently and asked her first how it was going.
Just as far as the project itself, without going into the web response, it's going fine. I mean, I'm eating a lunch and... you know, I just get through my day. It's one of those things. It's just now it's on my list of things to do in the day.
Now, it's been a long time since I've been in school, but some of those things take me back, those little fruit cups and the little pizzas and everything. And the visuals of this, you know, sometimes they don't look that appetizing.
Yeah.
I mean, but then again, you know, you go through in detail on every piece that is there on that lunch tray.
Yeah.
And some are better than others, right?
Yeah, some are much better than others. Some are really, really bad. And I mean, sometimes it's the quality, sometimes it's the taste, sometimes it's the size or portion size that they give that I think is small. Like there have been times where I thought, wow, that was a really small lunch. And I just thought, you know, because there are, well... in my school, there are small and big students. So I think about the little guys, that's probably enough. But for the bigger kids, you know, is that going to fill them up for the day? And are they going to be able to, you know, get through their afternoon on that? You know, sometimes it makes me wonder.
So of the lunches that you've had so far, what would you say are the best, both, I guess, in taste and what you would feel would be nutritional value, although you're not a dietitian?
I don't have a nutrition background
but,
at all.
And, you know, just sort of as a parent, you know, what you would want to feed your child and what is the best that you've had so far and what do you think is the worst that you've had so far?
I think the best was the Tex-Mex meal, which was like taco meat over rice. That was the main entree, and then the beans, and then some tortilla chips. So that was pretty good. Probably definitely my favorite. And then another one was some of the spaghetti hasn't been too bad. So that was really good. I think the worst are, well, for me personally, the pizza and the hot dogs. Probably the hot dogs are the worst. And not to say that, you know, hot dogs are high in quality, but, I mean, this doesn't taste like what I expect. I want, if I were to choose a hot dog to eat, it wouldn't be my choice.
Now, what prompted you to start this daily diary of school lunches?
You know, I can't even really think of one exact thing that just made me think of this. I've been working there for a few years, and... you know, over the years, I've noticed what they are eating, but I don't know. I more recently became a parent, and you know, here's a cafeteria in my workplace. They cook, or while they have food there, I thought I'm gonna just give it a shot, and I'm gonna blog about it. And I didn't realize how timely this topic is because you know, President Obama has been talking about school lunches. And he wants to increase funding to school lunches, and I think that's a really terrific thing. So it's very timely, and it's just a really coincidence that it turned out to be, you know, right at the right time to be doing this.
And, of course, you wouldn't be doing this unless you saw that there was a problem. At least there's something behind what you're doing.
Right, and that's the thing. I'm sort of walking a line in my blog, and that is that I believe there is a problem, but I don't want to directly criticize the administration too much, partially because they employ me. But, you know, I know that they're doing the best they can given the federal money that they get for the school lunches, because the school lunch program is federal, and I don't know how much control each state has, but I don't want to come out and just, you know, with guns ablaze and say that this is terrible food, and I'm really leaving that up to my commentators, people who share those, you know, opinions on the blog. You know, I want to be the kind of person that's putting out the information as objectively as I can and leaving the other people to draw conclusions. But yes, I do believe there is a problem with school lunches, and I don't think that, I don't care how rich or poor you are, you shouldn't get this from your school at lunch.
There are better alternatives, in your opinion.
I believe that we can do better, and I don't know if I'm the person to decide, you know, what that is, but I'm just here showing you what I see every day.
Now, we are keeping you anonymous because in your blog, you actually fear for your job.
Yes.
And you kind of want to be a whistleblower, but then you're saying you don't want to be, because it seems like the administrators aren't really the bad guys here. So, I mean, where does the blame lie?
You know, I'm just naturally a very nervous person. So for me, this is pretty wild. But basically, I don't know. I believe that basically, like a lot of bad decisions in life, somebody made a decision, yeah, why don't we individually package meals for children and have them reheated on site and then feed them those meals. And then as years went on, let's shave off some dollars and cents here, and now we're left with this kind of program that isn't sustainable, and it's not healthy, and I don't know who's benefiting from this. And all I know is that I think it's wrong, and I'd like to see some changes.
Let's talk about the reaction you've gotten about this blog. You have really tapped into something with this daily update of lunches.
Yeah.
Tell me about some of the comments and reaction you've gotten from people.
Well, I've been really, really shocked. To be perfectly honest, I thought maybe in a couple months I might get a few comments. But within 10 days, I got major, major blog activity and mentions on different foodie blogs. And I was absolutely blown away. I think that there's a couple reasons behind it. First of all, like I said, it's very timely with President Obama looking at reauthorizing the national federal school lunch nutrition program. They're going to do that later this year. So it's timely as far as current events. And then secondly, we are at a point in life where I think a lot of people are rethinking food in a major way. And nobody's really thought about, people think about their own lives, what they buy at the grocery store, and then they send their kids off to school and they just assume that the school is doing the very best it can to provide the child with quality food. And I know that on some level they really are doing the best they can with the money they have, especially in this economy. But when you have a look at the lunches, just objectively, here's what some kids ate today. And I'm not saying it's all kids. I'm just saying it's some kids, you know, some kids who ate this today and were expected to go back into class and focus on a teacher, learn, not fall asleep. I think that for some people it's just really resonating. And I think some of my favorite comments actually are people telling me about their experiences with school lunch. And some of them are really funny, you know, and they make me laugh. Other ones are sadder, where people say that, you know, they had bad lunches too, and or they had lunches that were better than that, and they thought their lunches were bad at the time, and how these lunches are stacking up against their personal experience. The reaction has been really fun. It's been just really, really rewarding. So that's great.
Well, if people want to follow your project here of documenting the lunches that you eat and the kids eat at your school, where can they go to?
They can go to my blog, which is fedupwithschoollunch.blogspot.com.
That was an Illinois school teacher who wants to only be known as Mrs. Q. She has made it her project to eat the same school lunches offered to students and talk about it on her blog, which she said can be found at fedupwithschoollunch.blogspot.com. Got attuned to Sidetrack. More and more people are getting directly involved in food, growing it, cooking it, even blogging about it. Some are going even further, plunging, literally, into the meat of the matter. Independent producer Guy Hand visited a class in Idaho where every student wields a knife and the desire to learn the fading art of butchery.
There was a time when the word butcher didn't dredge up thoughts of slasher movie mayhem.
I bought a meat shop just the other day.
The neighborhood butcher was as revered as the baker and the candlestick maker. But in the 60s, as industrial meat packers began delivering pre-cut chops to supermarkets, America's butchers started closing shop.
I guess I'll have to sell it cause I'm giving too much away.
Today, though, a revival has begun. As small-scale producers of quality meats and poultry proliferate, so too has an interest in artisanal meat cutting. And that brings me to Haley, Idaho, in a classroom strewn with lamb carcasses.
Excuse me. I'd like to welcome everyone to our first ever butchery class. And I'm already telling
That's Cheryl Bennett of Lava Lake Lamb, a small-scale producer of organic lamb based in the Wood River Valley. Lava Lake Lamb is sponsoring this one-day class for more than a dozen people.
This kind of came about for several reasons. We've been seeing some articles and seeing some web stuff about butchery classes, and it's kind of the vogue thing right now, actually, which is fairly interesting.
Butchery classes are becoming surprisingly popular in cities like New York, San Francisco, and Portland, Oregon. There are so few old-fashioned butchers left in America, they've attracted a kind of rock star following of knife-wielding groupies, some willing to pay thousands of dollars to learn this arcane art. Many plan to open their own boutique shops, but people at this class are here for more personal reasons.
I'm just really interested in good food and knowing where it comes from, so I'm excited to start from the beginning here.
Shot my first deer this year and had somebody else butcher it, and I want to get one step closer to the ground, shall we say.
We're fascinated and interested in providing local, good, organic food for ourselves and our 2.5-year-old daughter.
I like to cook, and I thought it'd be fun to learn more about cuts of meat. I've got an anniversary coming up, and I think this would be a really good idea for a gift for my wife.
Okay, so you'll just kind of gather around the table.
Longtime Rigby butcher Brent Jones is teaching the class. He stands knife in hand over a pink, skinless lamb carcass, its legs stretched out as if to leap away.
A lamb is broken down into four major primal cuts. A primal cut is anything that is in a solid piece before it goes into a portion steak.
Jones grabs a hoofless leg and pulls it toward him.
We have a leg. On that leg is a shank, and that's considered one piece.
No one seems the least bit squeamish. There's no blood, no guts. The carcass is clean and smells fresh, if slightly metallic in that raw meat way. When Jones plunges his knife into the animal, people lean forward.
Right here is where your tri-tip comes from. And on this line,
Brent Jones thinks this growing nationwide interest in butchery is born in part from fear, a fear that our modern food system isn't safe.
Everybody's concerned about where their food's coming from. And that's all started since, my opinion, 9/11. You know, everybody's worried about terrorists, they're worried about contamination, they're worried about recalls on all these meats. People want to know where they can get product from birth to plate. And what I mean by that is where the animal was born at and how it has been handled before they put it on their plate to eat it.
The recent recall of yet more E. coli tainted beef and the revelation that some producers sterilize their meat products with ammonia, well, that leaves a bad taste in many consumers' mouths. Some become vegetarians, but others have decided to take personal control over the meat they eat. Still, Jane Timberlake looks a little perplexed as she cuts into her lamb carcass.
I'm just trying to get through some of the bigger cuts and then remember what some of the smaller pieces are, waiting for them to pop out at me.
And have you done this sort of thing before?
Closest I've come was Thanksgiving, just deboning a turkey breast. So this is a little bit bigger.
Scott Mason, a local restaurateur, thinks learning the art of butchery will make participants more sophisticated cooks and consumers.
For a lot of people, I think food had become something that they bought prepackaged and they didn't understand even what they were eating. And so I think most of the people here, if you said, this is a top sirloin cut, they'd say, oh, a top sirloin cut. They know exactly where that comes from.
Mason thinks a butchery class can also make the abstract real, reminding us how meat gets to our plates.
You know, if you can't understand where it comes from and what it actually is that you're eating, you shouldn't be eating it. And so I think it's really important to know that these are whole animals. They were alive once. We killed them so that we could eat them.
That's, of course, why most of us pass the butchery off to others. Facing the facts of meat means facing life and death. Still, by distancing ourselves from our food, a growing number of eaters believe we've lost control of what we eat. A butchery class is one way this knife-wielding gang of students hopes to retake that control.
I've got the butcher blues and I just have to close my door.
In Haley, Idaho, I'm Guy Hand.
That story came from the program Edible Idaho. To hear more, visit them online at northwestfoodnews.com. You're listening to Sidetrack. Every elementary school student has heard the story of Revolutionary War hero John Paul Jones and his famous line, "I have not yet begun to fight." But there is more to the story of John Paul Jones, most of which didn't happen until way after his death. More from independent producer Nate DeMayo.
He had not yet begun to fight. He had been shot at. Bullets and cannonballs had torn holes through his ship and some of his shipmates. They were outgunned, and when the British captain had shouted and asked if he was ready to surrender, John Paul Jones said, "I have not yet begun to fight," which was a hell of a good line. And it was true. That was the way he rolled back then. And hours later, when his ship was on fire and had nearly sunk into the churning Atlantic, and his flag had been shot away, the other captain asked if he'd struck, if he'd pulled down his flag to surrender. And John Paul Jones said, "I may sink, but I'll be damned if I strike," which is also a hell of a line. He didn't remember actually saying that one, but it didn't matter. That's the way it got reported back home, and the people back home loved it. And it helped make him a bona fide hero of the Revolution, a great man in a time of great men. He had not yet begun to fight. He remembered that. And he remembered when he ordered his men to attack the British mainland, to take the fight right to him. And when he took prisoner after prisoner, ship after ship, wreaking havoc on the Royal Navy off the coast of Nova Scotia. And when he was honored by George Washington, and by the King of France. And how after the war, when other heroes moved on to governing, he kept fighting. He led the Russian Navy against the Turks. He fought pirates on behalf of the United States. He remembered all of that, though he wondered why no one else seemed to. Why, when he returned to Paris, and he used to run that town, he used to hang out with Ben Franklin, and they'd have French women falling all over themselves to get to them. But now, just, what, 15 years later? Geez, not even. Now he couldn't even get the Marquis de Lafayette to have dinner with him. They used to be tight. He remembered that, at least. He must have remembered all of it. As he sat alone in his apartment, as his cough was getting worse, and as he knew he was going to die. and could only hope that someone would come by to check in on him, so at least he wouldn't have to be alone when it happened. John Paul Jones died on July 18, 1791. At least we think so. He had been dead for quite a while when someone came in to check on him and found him slumped over. He was 45. There was no state funeral. There was no national day of mourning back home in the United States, despite the fact that he could have argued that there wouldn't even be a United States without him, if he could have found someone to go out to dinner with to listen. So, some servants and a few friends put him in a box and buried John Paul Jones in a cemetery for foreigners and Protestants. And then again, they forgot all about him. He had been shot at. Confederate shells exploded all around him. But the rebel brigade didn't break through. And Horace Porter got the Medal of Honor. You remember that. And when he became a general, and when he lived in the White House and worked as the personal secretary for his friend Ulysses Grant. That was something. But that was a long time ago. General Porter was now 67 years old. He was the ambassador to France. He was bored, and maybe a little lonely. So he went to look for John Paul Jones. The general knew the captain was buried somewhere in Paris, and he wanted to pay his respects. But no one seemed to know where his grave was. And that wasn't right. This was the father of the American Navy. There had to be, like, a monument somewhere. But no one he asked seemed to know where he was buried. And that's because no one did. After Jones's servants and so-called friends spread out the last shovelful of dirt, they were supposed to file some paperwork with the city. But they didn't bother to fill out the whole form. And now, 100 years later, no one knew where he was. And this wasn't right, thought the retired general. You don't just forget about John Paul Jones. After everything he did for his country, you just don't forget about people like that. And it turned out that at 67, Horace Porter had not yet begun to fight. It took him 6 years to figure out where Jones was buried. A lot had happened to the man since his death 108 years earlier. When he'd been put into the ground, that ground had been owned by the French royal family. And just a couple years later, the revolutionary government sold it for cash. And someone built a grocery store on top of it, a presumably haunted grocery store. Later on, there was a laundry and an apartment building whose walls and cesspools were dug right there among the coffins and corpses. By the time Horace Porter showed up with a shovel, John Paul Jones was buried in a pet cemetery, where people would watch dogs and roosters fight, and they'd place bets, and they'd dig holes in which to dump the losers. Horace Porter started digging. He assembled a team of excavators. Out of his own pocket, he paid off landlords of neighboring apartments so they'd let them dig. It took months. They dug tunnels. And they'd have to punch holes through the tops of them to get some fresh air in, because the smell of trash and dead animals and century-old corpses would send them reeling. But Horace Porter would be damned if he'd surrender. And then he found them. And he found that someone had planned ahead. John Paul Jones was buried in a lead coffin filled with alcohol. It was airtight. And when they opened it, there was Captain Jones, pickled, nearly perfectly preserved. It seems that when he died, an admirer, a Frenchman, didn't like that no one seemed to remember the captain. And so he sprung for an expensive casket in the alcohol, in the hopes that someday, someone might come looking for him. And he wanted to make sure that there was something left of Jones, in case that someone would be willing to give him the burial he deserved. So the general and the captain went back home. Jones was borne home by four American battleships. And Horace Porter earned himself another moment of glory, speaking alongside Teddy Roosevelt at the elaborate state funeral held for the man he spent 6 years looking for. Afterward, he spent another 7 years working on getting an elaborate sarcophagus built for Captain Jones in Annapolis, in marble, in an ostentatious rotunda, with gold dolphins. You can't miss it, which is for the best. And if you're looking for General Porter, and I'm sure he would appreciate it if you were, he's buried in the Old First Methodist Church Cemetery, West Long Branch, New Jersey, Section C, Lot 44. It seems he made sure that someone filled out the whole form.
That was independent producer Nate DeMeo. You can hear his podcast, The Memory Palace, at www.thememorypalace.us. Still to come, a rare recording of Langston Hughes speaking on the University of Illinois campus. And we chat with the widow of writer Louis L'Amour. Stay tuned. This is Sidetrack. The TI-99-4A, a dot matrix printer, and a text adventure game on a cassette drive. All of this and some poorly written basic programming awaits you. Well, at one time, this was the cutting edge of computers. And for author Tom Pappalardo, it was a time when he actually understood how his computer worked.
In the dark and foreboding days before quality personal computers, there was the TI-99-4A. By the time my mother bought me one in 1984, it was already an obsolete piece of equipment that Texas Instruments had stopped producing. But I had seen war games, and I suspected old computers could still be cool. I had no friends to tell me that my TI wasn't cool, so I was free to become a bigger dork than I already was. I would spend hours copying code out of computer magazines, painstakingly building tiny little graphics one bit at a time in TI Extended Basic. I would print out my code on pages and pages of continuous feed paper with my huge dot matrix printer. There was no reason to print it out, but I had nothing else to print out, so I printed it out. I once programmed my very own video game. It was loosely based on a James Bond movie I'd seen on TV. Imagine a white television screen, no colors, no sound. There was a black line across the bottom. On the left side of this line stood a little blocky man. This was you, the player. Your only movement options were run left, run right, or duck. On the right side of the line stood an identical blocky man, except he was facing you, and he was wearing a hat. Here's where the action heats up. Apropos of nothing, this man would throw his hat at you. You had to react quickly. If you didn't duck in time, his hat would remove your head, and your headless body would lie down on the line. Game over. However, if you successfully ducked and avoided this lethal headgear, you would be rewarded with nothing, because I didn't program anything for that. Instead, the man would throw another hat at you. He would continue throwing hats at regular intervals until you were inevitably killed. If you were truly brave and courageous, you could attempt to run across the screen to attack the hat-throwing man. Except there was no attack move, and when your player overlapped with the hat man, the program would crash. It was not a very good game. I had a few game cartridges, most of them knockoffs of popular Atari games. Parsec instead of Defender, Munchman instead of Pac-Man, TI Invaders instead of Space Invaders. They were pretty cool, but what really set off my geek radar was the text-based adventures. Text adventures, which came on audio cassettes, were interactive stories, choose-your-own-adventures of only text and a patiently blinking cursor. For those listeners who may have never experienced text-based gameplay, please allow me to present a simulation.
You are locked in a room.
Look.
There is a door.
Open door.
Cannot do that. The door is locked.
Unlock door.
Cannot do that.
Use key.
Cannot do that.
Kick door.
Cannot do that.
Punch door.
Cannot do that.
Ram door.
Cannot do that.
Door.
Cannot do that. You do not have a key.
It could go on like this for hours or days. I spent an unhealthy amount of time alone in my bedroom with that computer, and now that I'm an adult, I'm still basically doing the same thing. Except now, instead of a black and white Japanese TV set, I have a flat screen monitor. Instead of a wobbly little tray table, I have a nice big, only sort of wobbly IKEA table. And where I once suffered through the molasses-slow performance of the little TI, I now have a zippy PC running Windows, which practically almost never crashes. Much. I wonder why it is we feel nostalgic when it comes to something like old technology. I don't think it's the technology itself, but the time in our lives that we spent with the technology that brings on the fuzzy feelings. It's not a question of whether the technology was better or worse than it is now. It's that we got it. We held some level of mastery over it. No matter how meaningless our knowledge becomes a year or a decade later, it was an accomplishment for us at the time. It's why computer veterans speak with strange overtones of pride about using punch cards or 5-inch floppies. How they had all the DOS commands memorized, or how charmingly crude Atari 2600 games were. It's why old-school mechanics love to talk about carburetors, and graphic designers wax nostalgic about cutting and pasting with X-Acto knives and glue. And it's why aging geeks like to talk about time spent staring at pages of code so a little blocky man could get decapitated over and over again.
That essay from writer Tom Pappalardo.
We'll be right back.
You're tuned to Sidetrack. Last year, a pilot program called the American Archive Project provided grants to digitize recordings that had been stored in university archives and at public broadcasting stations. WILL is part of this program, and many archived recordings are now in the process of being made available to the public on the American Archive Project website. Many of the recordings relate to the civil rights movement, and one speaker was the poet and author Langston Hughes, whose birthday was this week. Hughes once wrote that his introduction to poetry came about as a byproduct of a racial stereotype. He said he felt his election as eighth grade class poet was due to a thought by his white classmates that African Americans were naturally rhythmic, a myth he denied. But writing a poem for his class graduation was a life-changing event for Hughes. Writing poetry was something he both loved and excelled at. As an introduction to the American Archive Project, and to celebrate the birthday of Hughes, we have an excerpt of a talk given by Hughes at the U of I in 1956, reading the poems The Negro Speaks of Rivers, I Too Am American, and Tomorrow.
That's very nice indeed to be back on your campus again. The last time that I read my poems here was at least 10 or 12 or somebody said last night 15 years ago. At any rate, it's been quite a little while, and certainly I hope that all the students who were here then have graduated by now. People ask, I suppose, of every poet, when did you begin to write? And I'm going to begin at the very beginning. I was born in Joplin, Missouri, but I belonged to a family that was always moving. Never wrote a thing, never dreamed about being a writer when I was a child. But when I was about 14, we moved to a town called Lincoln, Illinois, not too far from here. And on the day that I went into the class, they were talking about holding a class selection. Well, when they got way down at the last office, way down at the bottom of the board, under sergeant-at-arms even, it was the office of class poet, and there weren't any nominations. Finally, the teacher said, well, don't you want a class poet? And everybody said, yes. And she said, well, you have to nominate and elect someone. So at this point, a little white boy got up and turned around and looked at me and called my name, and right away the whole class said, aye, unanimously, and that's the way... That is the way I became a poet, by unanimous acclamation in the eighth grade. Well, fortunately, I had all winter long to write that poem. It wasn't due until June. When I stood up and read this poem at graduation time, however, the parents, the teachers, the pupils, everybody seemed to like it. They all applauded very loudly. That was the first applause I'd ever had in my life, my first real appearance before a large crowd, I guess. And I was so pleased by all this applause that I thought to myself, well, I'll just keep on writing poems. So I did. Perhaps I should read you two or three of the older of my poems that have been anthologized a great many times. The one that I'm going to read you now, The Negro Speaks of Rivers, it was written just after I'd graduated from high school. It's one of my very old poems. And my father had sent for me to come to Mexico to spend a year with him. So I got on the train in Cleveland, went down to St. Louis and changed trains to go on down to the Texas border into Mexico. The train that I was on went across the Mississippi River just at sunset time. So I found myself looking out the window of the train at this great muddy river flowing down toward the heart of the South. And for the first time, I really began to think about what the Mississippi meant historically to the Negro people. How to be sold down that river in slavery time was one of the worst things that could happen, to be sold into the rice fields, the cane fields of the Deep South. And then I remembered having read that Abraham Lincoln had gone down the Mississippi on a raft as a young man, and that he'd seen slavery at its worst in the Deep South. For the first time in his life, he saw the slave markets in New Orleans. He never forgot these human beings being bought and sold. In my own mind, this river began to link itself with rivers in our ancestral past, with the Congo and the Niger and the Nile in Africa. And so as the train went on into the night, I took out my father's letter, which was in my pocket here, and wrote down on the back of his envelope this poem, just about as I'll read it to you now, The Negro Speaks of Rivers. I've known rivers. I've known rivers ancient as the world and older than the flow of human blood in human veins. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. I bathed in the Euphrates when dawns were young. I built my hut near the Congo, and it lulled me to sleep. I looked upon the Nile and raised the pyramids above it. I heard the singing of the Mississippi when Abe Lincoln went down to New Orleans, and I've seen its muddy bosom turn all golden in the sunset. I've known rivers, ancient, dusky rivers. My soul has grown deep like the rivers. This one is called I Too Sing America. I Too Sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes, but I laugh and eat strong and grow well. Tomorrow, I'll sit at the table when company comes. Nobody will dare say to me, eat in the kitchen then. Besides, they'll see how beautiful I am and be ashamed. I, too, am America. So I think we can all look forward with the kind of optimism to tomorrow that I try to express in this final poem, a poem called Tomorrow. We have tomorrow bright before us like a flame. Yesterday, a night-gone thing, a sundown name. And dawn today, broad arch above the road we came. We march, Americans together, we march.
That was Langston Hughes, recorded at the University of Illinois in 1956. That feature was produced by Travis Stansel. You're listening to Sidetrack. Many writers who were popular in their day fade from public attention after they die. That hasn't happened with Louis L'Amour. The prolific author of Western and other adventure fiction passed away in 1988. But if anything, his books are more popular than ever, and new editions of his work continue to appear. The final volume in a series of Louis L'Amour short stories was issued recently. The Collected Short Stories of Louis L'Amour, Volume 7, was the first topic of conversation when AM580's Jim Meadows spoke with L'Amour's widow, Kathy L'Amour.
This book is subtitled The Frontier Stories, as are many of the other volumes, and I was struck by that. You're not calling them Western stories or cowboy stories. They're frontier stories, and I was wondering what that meant.
Well, you know, the frontier of America actually started on the East Coast. And so when a story is called a Western, it locates it automatically right on the western side of the United States and does not really leave room for it to have perhaps been located somewhere else. And these stories are located all over the frontier. And, you know, Louis had a wonderful book of essays called Frontier, with essays by him and fabulous photographs by David Munch. And that starts on the East Coast of America and works its way completely across the country, because the frontier was always to the west, depending on the period in which you lived.
So your husband set these stories essentially all over wherever the edge of the country was.
Well, yeah, and they're set all over the United States, but many of them, and probably most of them, in the Southwest.
When were these stories written? Did your husband stop writing short fiction after he started producing novels on a regular basis?
Oh, he loved the short story. And as you know, the short story is perhaps definitely a more difficult form to write in. And he loved the short story, and he got his early training from writing short stories. And he published in hundreds of magazines, and then someone asked him, did he have any novels? And he started writing novels, and of course the short story market went dead. Television came in, and the paperback book, and the magazines that carried the short stories were dying right and left. So there was no market for a while for the short story. But Louis always wrote short stories. He always wrote a few every year. He never could let go of it because he really loved that form. So he would write for the Saturday Evening Post or Saga or Collier's or whatever magazines were left, but there were very few of them. and he wrote some short stories for a couple of the airline magazines because they were always interested in a short piece by him. But the big money to be made from the short story was gone. And so the novel, of course, took over, and he became this enormous bestseller novelist, you know, and we've sold now over 300 million copies of Louis's books and over 100 million since he died, which is just unheard of in the publishing world.
I was wondering, because Western fiction as a genre, as a marketing genre, is not as big as it once was, but your late husband's fiction is certainly selling well. Why do you think it's endured?
I think it has endured because, number one, Louis was a great storyteller, is a great storyteller. And I think if you have that, of course you capture your audience so easily with the first page, usually, of a story by him. He had incredible energy, and it seemed to just come through his fingers onto the typewriter, and so it pops off the page to the reader. And you can't put it down. You know, it's very hard to put down a book of Louis, whether it be a short story or a full novel. He told a lot of different stories. And I think people love learning about their own heritage, about their own country, about their own geography, their own history. And all of that is captured in Louis's work. I get a lot of fan letters that tell me that people tell me that they've read and reread and reread his stories. It's amazing. A lot of people who've been through all of his books 5-6 times.
I'm reading one of your late husband's novels now. I'm reading Catlow, and I'm certainly being brought along with the story. But at the same time, I'm aware of, well, it's the 1870s, and there are things going on with the Texas cattle industry that drive the story, and there's Mexican politics, and Wild Bill Hickok makes an appearance, and I was wondering what role research, historical research, played in your husband's work.
He tried very hard to be historically accurate and geographically and geologically accurate. He was a great student of history of all kinds. We have over 20,000 volumes in our home library. They are all nonfiction. They are all research material. And Louis was an avid reader, and he had read many times more than that books to choose these to have in his library. So as a rule, his work is pretty much 100% accurate. And I'm sure that there are instances, perhaps in the very earliest of days, when he wasn't paying quite as much attention to the historical accuracy. But after the 1950s, he was geared for it and wanted very much to make his work reflect the time and the place that he was writing about.
He didn't always write stories about the West, but that's what he is known for, and I think what he seems to have made a conscious decision to focus on at one point. Was that strictly a commercial decision, or was that something that he really wanted to write about?
Well, in the beginning, he wasn't writing about the West. He was writing about the South Pacific, and he was writing about Soldiers of Fortune. He was writing about China. He was writing about India. He was writing about places all over the world and publishing in the pulp magazines all kinds of adventure stories and crime stories, detective stories. And then one of the editors asked him if he had any Westerns, and he said, oh, yes. And, of course, he didn't at all. But he sat down and wrote one, and they published it, and he wrote another, and they published it, and there were so many pulp magazines that were focused on the West. And, you know, they just devoured his material, and he wrote a lot. He felt he wrote better because he wrote a lot and when he wrote a lot. So he became more known for his Westerns, some of it due to the films that were made. I think we've had 45, I don't know, maybe more than that, films made from his work. So he became well known for it, and people were always coming to him right, asking for it. But, he wrote a 17-volume work story of the Sackett family, and that starts in Shakespeare's England and comes to America. He wrote a 12th-century novel about Europe and the Near East, starts in France, The Walking Drum. He wrote a modern book about an American pilot who was shot down over Russia during the Cold War. He's taken prisoner. He happens to be an American Indian, and he escapes, and he harkens back to his Indian heritage to really enable him to escape and stay alive, and he's tracked by the Russian counterpart of the American Indian. It's a great story. It goes all the way across Siberia. That took place in the 1980s. he wrote about a lot of things. He had a vast, wide range of interests. And so there was nothing he really couldn't write about. He was fascinated with ancient medicine, with ancient travel. He was fascinated with the ballet and opera and art and theater and the classics. And he'd had a very adventurous life, and he'd been almost everywhere in the world, not traveling first class, but traveling and working, many times working on board ships. So he had a lot of background. He was a professional fighter. He worked topping trees. He worked on ranches. He skinned dead cattle. He worked in mines. He worked for the circus. There weren't many things Louis hadn't done. And all of it, of course, became grist for the mill and really enhanced his work, I think.
And was he, as a man, the man you knew, did he have any of the qualities that he put into his characters?
Oh, I think so. Of course I think so. I mean, he was the perfect husband. He was the incredible father. He was an incredible friend and teacher. He was generous and giving and not very judgmental of people. He certainly had a great sense of humor, and he never complained about anything. He was fantastic. I always say I had it all because he was the perfect man, certainly the perfect man for me. But he had so much, and he appreciated women. He enjoyed the company of women. He was focused on his work and his family. That was his main focus.
When you first met him, I understood that you met him first in the early 1950s. On a double date, I understand, when you and him were not actually dating each other.
That's right. I knew a girl that he was dating, and she happened to have been in an acting class that I was in. That's how I met Louis. And I knew him for several years before we were married because he became engaged to her, and then they became disengaged, and then I just ran into him on the street one day. So, thank heaven. It was a perfect, wonderful day for me, and certainly opened my life up to an incredible life. You know, we did all kinds of great and exciting things, and we slept in cliff dwellings on the Indian reservation, and we were invited to the last treaty signing by two Indian tribes. We were the only, well, maybe there were four or five Anglo people there. We did a lot of things that were special. We had trips to the White House and meetings, of course, with the president and awards honored by the president and lunch and dinner at the White House. We were there several times, and we had great times traveling. It was wonderful to be with him on a trip because he knew all the side stories of all the areas where you were. He knew the little backstories. He knew the stories that nobody knew. And he made it wonderful for my children, for our children and me. So we had a very unusual, exciting, perfect life.
With the publication of the final volume of the collected short stories, is everything of your husband's that you would want to see in print now available in book form, or is there anything else that may be coming?
Oh, there might be something else coming. There might be something else coming. We still have a lot of things that were not published. Some were not finished. But everything that we've published thus far, everything is Louis' material. And we've been lucky that we had all this material because it's kept us strong in the literary world. You know, not too many short story collections sell like Louis' do. But they're fun to read, you know. They're just wonderful, fun reading. And I think people just are looking for something that's going to be entertaining. Please entertain me when I read. It's the best way to learn things, and it's the most fun way to involve yourself in something, in anything, really. So we might have more things. You just never know with us.
Kathy Lamour speaking from her Los Angeles home with Jim Meadows about the life and work of her late husband, Louis Lamour. The Collected Short Stories of Louis Lamour, Volume 7, was recently published by Lamour's longtime publisher, Bantam Books. More information about Louis Lamour can be found on the website maintained by his family, louislamour.com. That's one word, no apostrophe. Well, that does it for another edition of Sidetrack. Jay Pierce is our senior editor, and I'm your executive producer and host, Jason Croft. Past episodes of Sidetrack are available on our website, and you can subscribe to our podcast as well. Just go to will.illinois.edu/sidetrack. Sidetrack is a production of Illinois Public Media.